Okay, everybody. This is the Games and Simulation Committee meeting, which we're going to have a panel here in a moment. I'm Mark Wendling. I'm co-chair. Derek Baines, our other co-chair. We're just going to do a little bit of housekeeping for us. The big thing is, you know, we're supposed to have an election for the chairs for this year. Derek and I talked. We're both willing to stand for another year and do it. If you want to get involved, we got lots of jobs for you, so come see us and we'll give you. If you want to have an election, we'll do that through our various things. If you're here and not been to any of our committee stuff, we are on Facebook, Twitter. We have our own blog, so take a look, find us. We've had a half a dozen Zoom meetings with various people in the games area and simulations. We're very proud. I mean, this committee has been reinvigorated from a year ago when we had a meeting that we thought, or people thought, we'd only have a few people and they were lined up out the door. And today we got a pretty good number sitting here. So we're very pleased with the invigoration, and one of the things that, you know, it's not about one game or one simulation. We are quite prepared to help further anybody and their research and everything. We're very inclusive. So you can remember that. We've got a panel going. I know that's who you want to see, talk or listen to, not me, that's for sure. On the far end, we have Mike. Mike's a programmer, game maker. Next, we have Rob Nyer. Most of you know him from all the work, all the Sabercasts he does. He likes to talk about fantasy leagues and fantasy. And here we have Jeff, who's a media person for various games and done stuff. So basically marketing and likes to sell games. So I'm just going to leave it for them. Thanks, guys. Go ahead.
Well, I'll start because I'm going to wind up speaking way less than these two, so I get to go first. I've known Mike for a long time and have been a huge fan for as long. Jeff is one of three people who were basically responsible for me having a career, the other two being Don Zemenda, who many of you know, and Bill James, who I think most of you also know. So thanks to Jeff for all his help over the years. I started playing Strat-O-Matic many decades ago. Before that, I remember being struck by something that Bill wrote in an abstract when he wrote that Major League managers should all be compelled to play, 100 games of, or 1,000 games of tabletop baseball. He might have mentioned App, I think he said App or Strat-O-Matic. This was a while ago, 40 years ago, basically. And we can take this conversation in a lot of different ways, but I thought a fun way to lead off would be to ask these two guys, because obviously he built this game, and Jeff has played, I don't know how many thousands of hours you've spent playing, but and watching. I'm wondering how close modern baseball managers are to that sort of ideal that Bill envisioned when he said they should all be actually practicing with simulations. I don't think that Aaron Boone actually plays simulations, but clearly he's managing closer to what we might expect from someone who did that than say, Sparky Anderson 40 years ago. So what's the evolution?
So Craig Counsell actually started out playing our board game years ago when he was growing up. So, and he's, of course, the senior manager here in the National League. Tom Treblehorn is someone who I've presented the game to. So this is just a couple examples of some major league managers who've actually played the game. And certainly Craig Counsell is a current manager. I think the older managers, probably less into it, but I think more of the modern managers might be more amenable to playing a simulation as, I guess, practice for the real thing.
Well, even leaving aside whether they actually play, Jeff, I mean, how close? I guess the basic question is, how better are the managers now at the percentages than they were 40 years ago?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think this is a case more than anything of life starting to imitate art, right? Which is to say, as a sim baseball player, right, you're consciously aware it's a game of constantly really understanding how to optimize matchups. And I would argue that 30, 40 years ago, there weren't as many major league managers. I mean, Earl Weaver was a freak with the Baltimore Orioles, right, for how he would try to position a John Lowenstein or Benny Ayala for the perfect matchup. And that is the credo of being a successful simulation manager. So I think it's less that they are doing it and more that they have migrated towards some of the fundamental, you know, principles that make folks successful in a sim. Does that make any sense?
It does. I keep wondering if Bill would write the same thing today, and I think he probably wouldn't, because so many fewer moves are made that just sort of defy credulity.
I think that's right, and you know, I think that when he did it, when he wrote that, and I remember thinking, yeah, I'm way smarter than these guys. And that's at the essence of why a lot of us play, right? Because we believe in our heart of hearts, whether it be in the macro, and one of the things that Mike and his team have done have created these, you know, fantastic, you know, multi-season leagues that make you kind of think in terms of the next game as well as the next season. But there's also, you know, there are also those timeless debates as to whether or not, you know, when is the right time to use this pitcher, when is the right time to use this hitter. And I think that a modern manager has the benefit of actually, you know, more actual objective research that goes into this as opposed to just managing by instinct.
Yep. Sorry. So let's go back to the beginnings of Mike's game. I know that, you know, for many decades, I don't know how many people are, I know this is a simulation and games. Do we have fans here of, like, the ancient board games that the players would endorse and all those things? Because I'm fascinated by that kind of thing, too. I'd love to know more. But then, obviously, Stratomatic and Apple came along, and I'm sure there were a few others that were somewhat sophisticated. I think that a lot of us, or I would have assumed back in the 70s, that those were basically as good as games could get. Mike, I'm curious, what made you think, what was the inspiration for thinking, as relatively sophisticated as these games are, I can make a better one?
Well, when I started designing the original Pursue the Pennant game was the same time that Bill James' baseball abstracts were coming out. And I just devoured those abstracts. So I wanted all those different factors like ballpark effects and all these realistic nuances that weren't in other games to be in my game. So that was really the design impetus was, and there was a whole new revelation in baseball statistics at that time. So that was the impetus for design.
And what did you see in the other games that you thought you could improve upon?
We were always known for our ballpark effects. That was a big thing. Really, at the time when we finally debuted in 1985, none of the other baseball simulations had ballpark effects. And we tried to get more granular in terms of some of the ratings and really focus on a lot of realistic features that weren't in the game before. Like, for example, beyond the distances with the ballparks, foul territory effects, like in Oakland, you've got this humongous foul territory and building that in. Fenway Park has the tiny foul territory. Wrigley has got the tiny foul territory. So things like that, and include that in the game.
Jeff, when we were kids, App and Stratomatic were the popular games. And since then, there have been others. I know you've probably played all or almost all of them. What do you look for in a simulation?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the sense of realism is super important. I think there's also a layer on this that I wouldn't have anticipated that reminds me a little bit of, you know, my background. Rob and I go back to the early days of ESPN.com. I built the fantasy business there and launched fantasy games. And one of the things I fundamentally got wrong when I launched fantasy games there is I thought of it as a software product, and I did not adequately think about how online fantasy would trigger basically the formation of millions of communities of people who like to do something together. And I think that's an element of these games that it's really easy to overlook as you look at the relative statistical accuracy or the realism is how well those games foster communities. And I think that that's one of the primary elements right now is you know, I'm in a couple leagues in Dynasty, and I'm in leagues with guys for 10, 15 years. I consider a bunch of folks I've never met to be friends. And I'm interested in their lives, and they're interested in mine. So, you know, I think there is the actuarial part, there's the realism part, there's an ease of play, but there's also, it's a question of whose company are you keeping?
I was in the car with Mark Armour the other day, and he brought up something when I mentioned that I was doing this, and it's sort of a, it's an esoteric question, especially for game designers, I think, but there was always sort of an assumption that if you play a game, a simulation, and you've got a player card and it says he batted 300, you know that he's not going to bat 300 if you play him for a season. But your expectation is he'll be somewhere close, right? There was always, I think, this desire among, maybe there wasn't, players and designers to essentially duplicate the performance of the actual player. But Mark raised an interesting question. Would we rather have a game that duplicated not the statistics, but the abilities? Does that make sense? Because now so many teams in real baseball, they don't really care if a guy hit 300. They care about the little pieces that led to the 300. And that might mean he's not actually a 300 hitter fundamentally. He might be a 260 hitter. It's happened. Norm Cash, Bill just pointed this out the other day, there isn't that much difference between Norm Cash's 1961 and 1962 seasons, except for the batting average.
And the batting average.
Well, yes, there's some stories there too, but the actual fundamental bits, probably not that different. So I guess I'll ask you, Mike, what are you trying to duplicate? And then I'll ask Jeff, you could maybe follow up with what you want to duplicate.
So we've always had historical stats that the player cards are based on. You can do season replays. In our private draft leagues, you're going and you're playing one season to the next. So, but I think what Rob was mentioning, that's probably good if you're going to do projections and doing future seasons, right? Because if you look at major league front offices, that's how they usually do things, is trying to project forward based on abilities rather than past season stats.
It's a great question, but it's almost a fundamentally impossible one, because the question is, what are you optimizing for? So if you're trying to create the most realistic depiction of Juan Soto in 2023, are we representing Juan Soto when he plays at home in San Diego? Because he's about a 70-80 OPS guy right now doing that. Or are we trying to depict Juan Soto on the road, where he's very Juan Soto-y? So, you know, a lot of it really just, there is an inevitable degree of homogenization that occurs when you do this. So what you're looking for as a player is something that is directionally true, right? Juan Soto should be a better player than Mark Canna. And is he over the course of 100 games and by a satisfying level? I think it's less about whether or not the home run number hit on the nose.
Can you talk a little bit more about that as you're designing the game, or maybe you haven't changed your philosophy since you began, but what was the intention? Was it to create a player, a card that made a 300 hitter out of an actual 300 hitter? And has that evolved over time?
Yeah, the former. We're still trying to replicate past performance, so I don't think that's really ever changed. There's a lot of ratings in the game that you could use going forward. So you've got range ratings, durability ratings, we even have things like clutch ratings, pitchers being able to pitch out of a jam. So all those base running, you know, those are all things that are more skill oriented, right, that could go forward. So when you're building a team and you're looking for toolsy players, I think that helps. You know, if you're looking at players who typically always have speed, that, I think it was Wade Herzog said, speed never slumps, right? So.
How have you managed the flood of information over the last almost 40 years that's come in? And I'll just mention one example. The amount of information you had to manage on your way to fielding ratings 35 years ago is infinitesimal compared to the information that you have available now. And you've somehow, I'll give you an example. I was a voter for many years on what do we call it?
The baseball info.
Yeah, the baseball info. Wasn't called the Golden Glove. What do we call it? The Fielding Bible Awards. Thank you. It's been a couple years now. I had a lot of things that I looked at, but one of the things I would look at was Fangraph's fielding ratings and Baseball Prospectus's fielding ratings. And for the most part, they were pretty close. There were times when one guy looked like a Gold Glover in one system and the worst player in baseball in the other system. I didn't do it, so I guess I didn't want to do this too bad. I always wanted to reach out to this one person at both places and get them in a room and say, okay, you guys, can you explain to me how this happened? Because I have no idea. You're all working off the same raw data. So, Mike, how do you sift through all that stuff? Because people, I know that simulation players are fanatical about fielding ratings, right? Because it makes such a huge difference when you're building your team.
And before Mike jumps in, I think one of the things that his game does really well is you get punished. I mean, you can't hide a guy. You think you can hide a guy in the field, and if you've got a bad fielder out there, he's going to get found, and he's going to get found at the wrong time.
So that's a great question. So I'm doing the ratings, a combination of objective and subjective. So right now we're using StatCast data, we're using the Fielding Bible plus minus for the range rating. And like you said, Rob, sometimes you have these wildly divergent different metrics. So that's where I maybe go into the scouting report, seeing what people, you know, say when they actually look at a player and kind of take the sanity check, right? And that's really the best that you can do. But I think it's really good to have that kind of eyes on all the ratings instead of just having all the ratings be strictly by formula, because I think you get some weird ratings when you do that, especially when you have small sample sizes.
Right.
I mean, you could... I think the problem for me was always that I didn't know where the numbers were coming from, so I would sometimes just fall back on the previous season. Like, could he have changed that much in this one season? Probably not. But maybe he could have. And you're not going to know unless you do a deep dive into each player, and I suspect even you don't have time for that.
Actually, I do. There's a lot of work that goes into the ratings.
Can you give us an example of that process, maybe with one player in particular?
Oh, I can't think of one player in particular, but... most of the time, actually, the data has gotten so much better with the fielding ratings. I tell people that when I first started out, I felt like Indiana Jones on an archaeological dig trying to get information. This is like back 1981, you know, there was nothing. If I wanted to find lefty-righty splits, I was going directly to Baseball Hall of Fame. I was writing to Bill James, Pete Palmer, John Thorne. So it was really difficult to come to data. It's so easy now. So StatCast, the outs above average, that's a great stat. I think we weight that more heavily even now than the Fielding Bible plus minus. But I look at both of those, and I'm also looking at scouting reports. So I think I probably put more time into the range ratings than any other rating. And then many of the ratings are just done by formula, so those are easy. They're already automatically done, so but there is a lot of time spent on the ratings.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a little in-depth stuff about game design. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but obviously when you are trying to build something like what you've built, you've got to be thinking about playability. You've got to be thinking about attractiveness, the design of the cards, that's part of playability, but it's also just there's an aesthetic quality there that can attract people. And then one thing that I think has changed because of the internet is you have an ability to create communities around this game, right? And you've got to factor that into the design and the output. So maybe you can talk about some of your thoughts about all those things and how they all fit together, and then Jeff, who's experienced it, can talk about how it actually works and what his priorities are.
So we have our original board game. I think Derek has it displayed up there, right? So that's actually the first edition that we came out with. And we've really upgraded the game components. The cards are pre-cut. We've got these colorful ballpark charts. It's on glossy cardstock. So you try to make it as attractive as possible. If I don't know, how many people have played the original Pursue the Pennant game with the box that had the ballpark insert walls?
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. So that those were all to give a visual representation of the ballparks. Now, with the online version, we can do that in different ways where we have like outside the park shots. And then you enter the park and you go inside. So it gives you the feeling as if you're walking into the ballpark. And as far as the communities, you know, Rob's right. So the online version was meant to take draft leagues and make it really, really easy for you to run a draft league. We've got players from New Zealand, all across the United States, and we could never have done that. Our Sunday Night Baseball League started in Brookfield, Wisconsin, in our dining room table. We have 8 to 10 guys come over for an afternoon and play the board game head-to-head. So everything has just changed so radically. Jeff asked me before, could you ever have imagined your board game now turning into an online version? And I could never have thought of that back in 1985 when it first came out.
What's your transition been like, Jeff?
It's hard to describe. I mean, it is. By the way, you've not really managed a calendar until you try to coordinate 7 series a year with a guy in New Zealand. they are plus 16 hours for those of you who are interested. It's been an enormous amount of fun, and realistically speaking, having grown up with dice, you know, starting, I don't know, did anybody ever play the old Sports Illustrated games? That was probably the first one I played was the Sports Illustrated game, and it's something that I don't remember the transition. It's a little bit like saying, you know, what was your life like before you had a smartphone? So I'm going to add very little to this.
Well, I remember 20-some years ago, you just being incredibly excited to tell me about how many games you were playing online with either strangers, or maybe you were just replicating seasons solitaire.
Yeah, I was doing both, and I still do. I still play a fair amount of solitaire and stuff like that. And it's fun. You know, I think the really interesting thing about the category, and it's, I'd be curious about from the committee's point of view, is that to me right now, it's at a really interesting pinnacle between the functionality that the online systems allow and the degree of still kind of imagination that is required to really fully, you know, enjoy the experience. I mean, there's a fairly low-tech graphical animation as to what's happening. But the fact of the matter is, it's still a game that's being played as much in your head as it's being played in your monitor, and it'll be interesting, you know, just in a time where, you know, succeeding generations of fans are expecting everything to be so VOD oriented. You know, will future games require basically some API that says, okay, if Francisco Alvarez hits a home run, we're going to dial up a home run out of the MLB archives in order to fully realize that. And I think that'll, you know, it'll be a great game, and it'll be super exciting and stuff like that, and it'll allow Major League Baseball to put their thumb on Mike, which is something they really enjoy doing. But I'm not sure in the end run it's a better experience.
Well, I think for me, what has limited my ability to play in the modern era, i.e. the last 10, 15 years, is that what I always have always enjoyed about games is actually sitting across the table from somebody and having a human interaction, because I spend enough time sitting in front of a screen by myself as it is. But it does occur to me, and I'm sure I'm way behind the curve here, that now with video conferencing and Zoom, you could have that face-to-face interaction and roll the dice if you really want to, and assuming the person you're playing with trusts your dice reading. I guess you could train a camera on the dice box at the same time.
There's a live chat function in the
You mean typing?
Yeah.
Not the same.
I've
tried to play some games online with type, and people just get mad at me when I'm too slow. And, you know, I guess if you're with friends, they'll be nice. But I gotta have this thing.
Well, people spend a lot of the time being mad at you, Rob. I mean, it doesn't require that's a
true
scenario.
That is true. All right, I'm kind of out of questions. What do you guys, what's on your mind?
I'm curious just the nature of this committee meeting. I mean, just where do you see the category going and what role does Sabre play in terms of helping the category mature?
Well, I guess from my perspective, I grew up on the computer gaming side of things. Micro League, Earl Weaver, Tony La Russa, those games. So there wasn't a lot of personal interaction. I was either me against the computer, sometimes a friend would come over and you would put your, the game card like this so you couldn't see what the other guy was typing. Yeah. But that gets old pretty quick. So I like the fact that you can do this. You know, now there's the online. You can, like you said, with somebody in New Zealand, you can play with pretty much anybody. So I like the direction it's going. Like you said, the Zoom calls with the tabletop, you know, you can roll the dice. And I think there's room for everybody. You know, if you're a fan of tabletop, you're used to that. That's what you grew up with. That's probably your game of choice. I grew up with the computer side, so that's my preference. But I just like to see the diversity. There's so many games out there. There's so many different types of games, and now there's more ways of playing. So
we could piggyback off the previous presentation as well, Mike. What are your thoughts on integrating Negro Leagues players into the simulation universe?
It's definitely something that we could do. We've got so many past seasons that are on deck right now that it's not a high priority, but you know, it's something we could do down the road. There's just no shortage of seasons to do. So we're trying to do all the past seasons consecutively, because a lot of our leagues will start at one older season and then continue forward building their teams towards the future, so they can go season to season.
I just wanted to add to a few things here. I think the games today give such a wide range of what do you really want to do. I mean, you can play MLB The Show and be the player and hit the ball, or in my case, strike out a lot. Or you can pick up a game and be the manager for that, you know, for that game and the box score and everything else. Or one of the things I like to do a lot is kind of be the manager or the general manager and making the trades and trying to build something year after year, as Mike was just mentioning, you know, to try to build a franchise and a winning franchise, which I can't seem to do either. And builds into the communities, which was early on, and that's, you know, that's where a lot of it is. But I think what it is there's so much now, you can find what you really have a passion for. And that's how things have really changed. You know, it's not just Rotisserie, it's not just Stratomatic or APBA. You know, you can find what you want. And Derek and I mean, as we've reignited this committee, and thank everybody for coming to the Zoom meetings and stuff, you know, that is what we're going to do. We're going to help encourage anybody, whichever area they're in. One of the fallbacks or the difficulties we have is anybody who's doing research in this area, it's non-traditional. And I'm actually going to have a discussion with a couple of people later in the weekend to talk about, you know, I think we get put behind because it's non-traditional, and let's make sure we don't get lost. Because let's face it, analytical, which we now have a whole conference for, was non-traditional at one point. And it's mainstream and actually draws in a lot of members. And I think with the computer simulations and games and stuff, I think that's how we're going to appeal to a lot of younger members and get our demographics a little bit younger. We can with simulations, we can answer the age-old question, what if Babe Ruth was hitting against Shohei Ohtani? Did he strike out or not, you know? or Babe Ruth against Nolan Ryan, or Mickey Mantle against whoever. I do find in a couple of the simulations I do that have the history and have the Negro Leagues, which, you know, dovetails nicely into what we are here, they still have the Negro Leagues as AAA. And I think they're going to need to make some adjustments, but, you know, it becomes cost and profit and everything else, whether or not they'll go back and do some of that work. But I think right now we're on the cusp of so many things. And it's what you have fun with. I mean, let's face it, for most of us, this is a hobby. We're not making millions of dollars at it.
I'm curious how many folks here who play are playing multi-season kind of franchise leagues like Mike has described versus one-off seasons. Yeah, I mean, for those of you who haven't tried it, I would just so wholeheartedly recommend giving it a go, because it is, you know, we as fans are very much back to how Rob opened up this notion of, you know, learning how to manage a game by having played a tabletop game. And we think very much in that notion of, you know, trying to get the matchups and stuff like that. Punching the walls out and starting to think in terms of multi-year management of a franchise, I think just so aligns you with the current thinking, the way baseball runs, right? Every baseball general manager is going into a season thinking in terms of, okay, am I optimizing this team for a run this year? Am I playing for 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line? And you know, in the league that Mike and I are in together, I mean, I had the best team I've ever had in any of these leagues last year. It had close to a 700 winning percentage. But I knew over the winter I was going to have to tear the thing down. And then the question is, okay, how do you do that? How do you unload salary? How do you do that? And it's just a really fun exercise that I think makes it actually makes me feel more connected to the way baseball actually works.
Derek, do you want to go through the slides real quickly just to give people a sense of what the game looks like? I think I already talked about that Paul Mahler was actually the first person the second. Dennis Martinez was the first. Paul Mahler was the second in terms of playing the prototype of the game that I designed. And the Milwaukee Brewers were actually helped me launch the game. So we can go to the next slide. There's Jim Gantner, Bob McClure. They were limited partners with me. The game on the right is the first edition, and it's in the Cooperstown Hall of Fame permanent archive. So even though I'll never be in the Hall of Fame, my game is. So next slide. This is on the cover of the St. Paul Pioneer Press Dispatch. That's the Pursuit of Pennant second edition that had the ballpark wall inserts. And that was very, very popular. It was very unique and gave the visual aspect of the ballparks. Next slide. And this is the current game with the ballpark charts, the player cards. Renowned for our depth of realism. You can see the ballpark charts just by looking at this. There's a lot of depth in the ballpark charts, I think, of almost any other simulation. Next. Okay, so this is the online version. It's for Mac, Windows, iOS, and Android. This is the screen that you start at when you start a game. And like I mentioned before, you start outside the park, and then when your opponent arrives, you click the Enter Park button, and you go into the park. And it just has the feeling of you walking into the park. So that was the thing that we wanted to convey. And here's the first screen that you'll see once you're starting the game. I did this for Jeff. This is the pop-up of Tom Seaver, 1969 player card. So you're going to make your GM decisions here and who you're going to have on your roster in terms of maybe demoting a minor league player or calling up someone from the minors. And here's where you make your lineup. So you have save lineups that you can make, and you can see all the different stats and ratings that are there. It's a great interface. I think you can see that it's really clear and crisp. Had to get this photo in of Guaranteed Rate Field, right, since we're going to be going there. But you can see all the, we talked about the range ratings. So if you look at the players on the field, the letter grade to the far left, that is their range rating. So we've got, this is a 2022 season game, and the second rated, the numerical rating, is their air rating. So the range ratings go from F to A+, A+ being Ozzie Smith in his best year. And then the air ratings go from 5, which would be a historically bad fielding percentage at that position, up to 100, which would be a historically great fielding percentage at that position. And this is also the screen where you'll make your manager decisions. Now, when you're, since this is multiplayer, one of the things that we tried to accomplish is that each player has his own screen. So when you're an offense, you have your own screen. You're not sharing a screen with another person. They have, they're seeing the defensive decisions. So it's true multiplayer. When you're in a draft league, as soon as the game is over, all of your stats and standings and leaders are updated in real time. It's not like you have to import and export the files to a commissioner. This is like next gen, so everything is available in real time. Okay, next screen. I wanted to show this because this is a new feature that we came out with. I don't know if you can see it clearly, but there's 7 different outfield distance locations. You can mouse over any of those distance locations, and a section of the ballpark chart will pop up. And I'm not sure if it's clear, but if you look at the very bottom, if you hit the ball 400 and I think it's 35 feet, it's a home run onto Waveland Avenue. So each of these special home runs is actually included. 370 is a home run into the basket, and this is left field. And if you were looking, if you would put your mouse over the right field, you'd have a home run onto Sheffield Avenue. So we want to create these special home runs for the game. And the same with Comiskey. Now you see the home run over the roof is 485, and this is down the right field line in Old Comiskey Park. These ballpark backgrounds, by the way, we have high resolution, wide angle photos that we use. And also we have artist renditions. That last one, probably a lot of you are familiar with the old Goff ballpark artist. We actually got a hold of those. They sent us the original artwork, and we were able to scan that in. So it's a really high resolution image. Here is a range play. So we talked about range before, and a pie chart will pop up. And this is actually coming from data that's inside the range chart. So this is Nico Horner on a range play. He's got a range. And the blue is the safe percentage. The red is the out percentage based on his range and the type of range play it is. And this is a great thing for the Sabre Convention, right? So in the game summary, and you can look at this actually in game and at the end of the game, we've got the win probability graph. Okay, so this is Dave Kirpin, one of our avid players. I don't know if Derek can actually get the video going, but this is his championship game. We'll see if the sound comes on. I don't know if you can make that out, but Dave is saying 20 years. 20 years he had been playing in his draft league, he finally won. So he told me afterwards, this was more exciting for him winning his draft league as his Mets team than if the actual Mets had won. It meant more to him.
Mike, as a designer, could you explain for the rest of us how you understand the difference between the historical player's abilities and qualities, the abilities and qualities of the, we call it a player chart, if it was tabletop, with the player data from which the simulation proceeds, and the outcomes the player is associated with in simulation play.
So I think...
How do you understand they're not the same thing?
Yeah, well, I've actually met with a lot of MLB front office people, and they always talk about the range of outcomes. So you always can expect outlier results, but we try to get, I guess, as close as we can to the mean and what the player actually did. But you're always going to have outlier results, especially if you have smaller sample size. Relievers are kind of notorious for being more of outliers because they have so few innings to start with, so hard to get them closer.
So would you then say that your goal for realism is matching the means to the historical performance from the season in question?
Yeah, I think ideally, although the expectation has to be that anything can happen in terms of the outliers.
I think this is a question about the next generation of games. Jeff made an interesting comment about how he's got his great team, but he knows he's going to tear it down. My problem playing in a dynasty league is that I know too much. I know what those guys did last year, so I know what they're going to do for me this year. If I want to be a GM, which is what I want to be, then I ought to be making my decisions with no knowledge, really, with my best guess of what I want to do. And the only way I can think to do that is that, in effect, a computer would build a card for me every day, that you'd be hooked up to it, to a database, and it would change as the season went along. But I would constantly have a today lineup. So if I made the decision last year to take a risk on Ronald Acuna, I'd be getting rewarded. If I made a decision based on, I can't think of anybody at the moment, who just bombed this year, I'd be penalized for that. It would be like a real GM. Is that a possibility?
Actually, we discussed, Jamie and I, our developer, that same type of concept, and we've come out with a way to actually be able to access our player card databases online and import data in real time so we could change it. So we just talked about this in concept. There's a lot of complications in doing that, much longer than I have to talk about, but I guess it is possible.
I'm a Strat guy. I started in basic in the 60s, and since then many features have been added, and I know Pursue the Pennant has many features. And one of the problems that I know for people who are introduced to the game is that they don't know how to reach expectations about accuracy. You know, the basic side has just, 36 permutations per column, and it's not very hard for us to figure that. But as these other factors get issued in, they find it more difficult to accept results that they didn't anticipate, especially for the computer where a lot of the math is happening under the hood. So I don't know Pursue the Pennant so well, but how do you manage those expectations and tell people about the probabilities and why things might not work out the way they expect it to? One of the big ones is they take all the worst players out of the league.
Yeah, that's a good question. So we actually have a transparent engine. So you actually see how all the results are resolved. And when a result comes up, you actually see the player card and where the result came up on the player card. And you even see the dice rolls. And those dice rolls are tracked in the game summary. So you could go back to the board game and recreate every single one of the game results if you wanted to. So I think the open engine makes it a lot more interesting, and also I think resolves a lot of the issues that you mentioned.
And I think one of the challenges you have as a game designer is, as fans, you know, the notion of outcomes being a function of skill versus luck are not readily apparent to us watching a game. But you better believe there is a big component of luck involved in live baseball. I mean, and it just, you know, these guys who build the games get punished when outlying events occur, but in baseball we celebrate when some scrub goes 5 for 5. So, you know, it's a tricky juxtaposition.
I was just gonna, sorry, yeah. Tom, just one sec. To the gentleman who was talking about, like, doing franchise, but already kind of know the results. There are softwares that you can keep going into 2035, 36 with players that are generated or players that are in the minors now where you don't know that, so that you can try your luck or try your expertise on that. Like I said, there's so much out there to meet what you are looking for. And just ask in our groups.
It's interesting right now, technology-wise, 2023, with AI exploding the way it is, and then virtual reality exploding the way it is. And for those, everyone's probably heard the news, right? Apple announced their version of the VR headsets, which are $3,500, but we need to trust Apple's going to change the market. They did with the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, and the iWatch, so they will here as well. They've got a pretty good batting average at doing that. I'm wondering, for the games and simulation world, MLB The Show and a few other games have really great graphics, but is who in the industry of more general manager, stat-driven games is looking at, if you guys know of anyone, who's looking at AI and VR to really up the feel of simulation games, the visual appeal of that? Because there will be so much we can do with, leave VR even aside, although that would be impressive, just AI to be able to take like Honus Wagner and have him actually look like Honus Wagner playing in a simulated game.
I've been involved in digital sports for 30 some odd years, and we're at a really interesting point in the industry right now. As pertains to all the stuff, whether you're talking about AI or VR or even stuff like OTT, which is that we're at a point where the capabilities of the technology are not necessarily the biggest constraining factor in terms of creating those next generation experiences. The complexity of the underlying rights are actually as big a barrier to these fully realized experiences as is the technology. And you know, it, like anything else, right, there will be unintended consequences as these things get more visually oriented, because it's going to mean that you know, just like for years there's been one and only one NFL simulation out there, EA has enjoyed a monopoly. You know, there is the potential, if you want to make this more visually oriented, that the market will get, you know, really constricted in terms of who all can participate. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation, but I think, you know, beyond just thinking about the technical evolution, you also have to not have an eye towards how the rights conversations evolve. And here you've got both players' associations and MLB teams involved, so it won't end well.
All right, I have a question for both of you, Jeff and Mike. Mike, from what I understand, you originally designed your game in 1981, but didn't launch it until 1985. Did you simulate like a lot of seasons to kind of make sure that the results were realistic, I guess? How did you go about developing that? Second question for you is, how did you determine the dynasty teams that you were using? I think it was based on Rob's book, if I understand correctly. And then Jeff, were you involved with the development of the fantasy baseball site on ESPN?
The what, I'm sorry?
The fantasy baseball site?
Yeah, I built that.
And can you comment, I don't know if you had anything to do with the decision of how to handle Ohtani, the Ohtani situation.
I was running Yahoo Fantasy during when Ohtani first came out, and we made a horrible decision that was more a reflection of just the inflexibility of the vestigial code base to be able to adequately treat somebody as a two-way player. It was not a decision that was necessarily made in the interest of creating the greatest game experience, but in terms of saving us, you know, an inordinate amount of time of fixing, you know, fixing that stuff. By the way, 1981 is a perfect example of just how difficult it is to quote unquote mirror reality, right? 1981, a strike shortened season. As a player, what would you find most satisfying at the end of a 162 game season in terms of who won the NL West, right? Because Cincinnati had the most wins, LA won half the season, Houston won half the season, Cincinnati didn't even make the postseason. How does Mike come up with a true outcome there, right? So, I don't know, it's just a weird season. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so how I originally started is I had a self-directed study at University of Miami And as part of that, I had an internship at the Baltimore Orioles. And that allowed me to get access to basically players, broadcasters. So I was lucky enough that my playtesting, two of the first people who I playtested the game with were Dennis Martinez and John Miller at his condo in Key Biscayne. So how many people have that opportunity, you know, to have those kind of, you know, people? I would have Larry King sitting next to me in the press box checking in, Chuck Thompson, Brooks Robinson. So I had a really neat situation. And then, as we showed in the slide before, Paul Molitor also play-tested. So I didn't have the ability at that point to run thousands of simulations. I just had to trust my calculations, basically.
Okay, it looks like we're coming to time, and you'd think somebody like Ozzie Guillen's coming in here.
Yeah, that was great. I really enjoyed it. You did a great job. I think it went off.
I want to thank everybody. I want to thank our panel. I'm just going to close with two things that the great FX Flynn had mentioned in one of our calls this year to everybody who plays games and simulations. First of all, nobody cares about your team but you. That's something to remember. And the second thing is, if you ever win any prize money, make sure you spend it on your partner, because you put them through hell. Thanks, everybody.